Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Thursday, July 24th, 2025. And here are today's business headlines. A hot protein bar company has added a wild new product, frozen cod fillets. McDonald's to test dirty sodas and flavored cold brews. The West's insatiable demand for missiles boosting U.S. weapons makers. Tesla profit falls, hurt by plunging EV sales. Biden sells memoir for roughly $10 million, less than Obama and Clinton. T-Mobile adds more subscribers than rivals. Waystar strikes deal for iodine software. Health Aid Kombucha sells for $500 million. Blank Check Company strikes cryptocurrency deal. The first article I'll read today is a hot protein bar company has added a wild new product, frozen cod fillets. David hopes selling fish will make an impression on both shoppers and critics of processed food. By Megan Graham. David Protein has begun selling frozen fillets of raw cod alongside its fudge, brownie, and blueberry pie bars. The company, since introducing its bars last September, has won a large following of customers, but at times has heard criticism from some critics of processed food. It's now selling four pieces of wild-caught Pacific cod sourced from a sustainable fishing company at $55 online, where it also charges $39 for a box of 12 protein bars. Its fish also recently became available at Happier Grocery in New York City. Billboards promoting the product say, "Boiled cod, slightly more protein per calorie than our bars." David's co-founder and chief executive, Peter Rahal, who previously co-founded RXBAR and sold it to Kellogg for $600 million, spoke to the Wall Street Journal about the marketing message behind its push. The interview has been edited and condensed. Wall Street Journal says, "What led up to launching the cod on your website?" Peter Rahal said, "Ultimately, people want an easy way to get protein, because it turns out it's quite hard. In our product, 75% of our calories are coming from protein. To contextualize that product performance against the broader food landscape, processed or unprocessed, we put a comparison table on our website. Our chief science officer was like, 'Well, what has a better protein to calorie ratio than our bar?' We started searching and found boiled cod. Obviously, it had to be boiled. If you saute it in butter, it doesn't work. So we placed it there. It was kind of an Easter egg." Wall Street Journal asks, "When did you decide to actually sell it?" Rahal said, "I felt we are getting a stale a bit. It was like, we're going to do something bold that sparks the conversation. That was around April. Then we mobilized. We needed to find the good, high-quality raw material. We needed to figure out the planning. We needed to figure out frozen logistics. We ended up putting them up for sale in mid-July. It's not a gimmick. Well, it is a gimmick, but we're actually seriously selling cod. Time will tell if the market likes it or not." Wall Street Journal asks, "You've been weighed in online responding to critics who point out David being a processed food. How does the cod fit into that?" Rahal, "Most of the conversations on nutrition are really often emotional, and we think it's important to have an intellectual view. People use buzzwords and binary thinking. Processed is bad, natural is good. And that frame is just outdated or unhelpful. Nearly everything we eat is processed anyway, and you need it for food safety, so it's just not helpful. What actually matters is what's in the food." When we launched the protein bar, some of our critics were from the ancestral nutrition crowd. Selling cod allowed us to address and respond to the criticism in a clever way. It's our tongue-in-cheek innovation that reinforces the same three principles that really matter in protein bars: convenience, price, and taste. Wall Street Journal. I imagine shipping cod to consumers is not a simple feat. Rahal. We worked with fisherman Kyle and sourced high-quality, wild-caught cod, and then we branded it, too. Insulation is super important to keep temperature, and then you pack it with dry ice, and you do it overnight. Wall Street Journal. How are you marketing this push? Rahal. What I really love about the campaign is that it's like a giant riddle. The big push was literally just making a product, and then the photo shoot. As a marketer, I think it's important to not overdo it. Internally, some ideas are like, let's get some merch and let's... It's like, no, too much. Wall Street Journal, what are you hoping people take away from this? Rahal, if you're sitting at home all day and have all the time to prepare fresh foods, great. That should be the way to eat. No one's arguing that, but it turns out it's really hard to do that. And it turns out it's really expensive, and it's hard to get that amount of protein. On a fundamental level, it's ultimately a clever way to communicate to consumers the surplus that the brand creates. What would you actually pay in the market for 20 grams of protein? Write to Megan Graham at megan.graham@wsj.com. McDonald's to test dirty sodas and flavored cold brews to cash in on drinks craze. Burger Giant aims to edge into cold brews, refreshers, and other iced drinks that have driven sales for other fast food chains. By Heather Haddon. The chain behind the Big Mac and Chicken McNuggets is gearing up to offer creamy vanilla cold brews, popping tropic refreshers, and other brightly colored iced drinks. McDonald's plans to test launch the range of coffees, refreshers, and dirty sodas, spiked with add-ins such as dried fruit and flavored syrups, at several hundred of its U.S. restaurants in September. The Golden Arches joins broader fast food industry push into premium drinks, which is powering sales for rivals such as Taco Bell and Wendy's. The trends are all pointing in the same direction, and we can say that's driven by Gen Z, said Charlie Neuberger, head of McDonald's beverage and dessert offerings. The chain intends to learn what customers want to sip and how the novelty drinks can be worked into the chain's busy kitchens. Beverages have been one of the hottest growth businesses for U.S. restaurants at a time when the industry has struggled to draw inflation-fatigued consumers. Sales at beverage and snack-focused restaurant chains grew 9.6% in 2024, the biggest annual increase of any restaurant category, according to market research firm Technomic. Burgers generated higher sales overall last year, but they grew 1.4% over the same period. That's putting fast food chains into competition with coffee chains such as Starbucks, Dunkin', and Dutch Bros. McDonald's has estimated beverages could represent a $100 billion consumer market in the United States, Canada, Australia, and parts of Europe. The drinks tend to attract younger consumers and deliver higher profits for operators, according to executives. McDonald's took one shot in December 2023 with the launch of an alien-themed spin-off called Cosmex. The goal was to test the market for novelty beverages without gunking up the works in McDonald's existing restaurants, Chief Executive Chris Campanzini's phrasing at the time. The company built a total of 8 Cosmex locations in Illinois and Texas. The first stores initially attracted big lines of customers, ordering churro cold brew fraps and dozens of other non-alcoholic drinks, but the sensation faded and McDonald's pulled the plug in May, saying Cosmic's had served its purpose. Neuberger, who also led Cosmic's, said the sci-fi experiment was instructive. The turmeric spice latte was a bit too edgy for the McDonald's crowd, he said, while its creamy avocado tomatillo sandwiches and other food options couldn't compete with McDonald's fries. The purpose of Cosmic's was for us to push the fringes, he said. Cosmic's customers didn't customize their drinks as much as the company had anticipated, Neuberger said, making it more realistic for McDonald's to offer a streamlined range of toppings and syrups for the coming beverage test. McDonald's will introduce around 10 drinks in roughly 500 McDonald's restaurants, concentrated in Wisconsin and Colorado. The company also aims to test novelty beverages internationally, with different flavors. Europeans tend to prefer lemon, orange, and mint drinks, while Americans prefer berry and citrus flavors, Neuberger said. Meanwhile, Taco Bell recently released a line of fruity Refresca drinks, and later this year aims to expand a beverage-focused concept called Live Mas Café, with more than 30 of its restaurants. KFC is dabbling in the dirty soda beverage trend, while Burger King released a frozen cotton candy drink this summer. Neuberger said McDonald's aims to move swiftly to act on what it learns from the pilot. You can sense this urgency from us in an organization to get in, Neuberger said, about drinks. Write to Heather Haddon at heather.haddon, that's H-A-D-D-O-N, at WSJ.com. The West's insatiable demand for missiles boosting U.S. weapons makers. Orders for munitions and interceptors are up, buoying defense contractors struggling with costly problems in other divisions. By Drew Fitzgerald. It's a good time to be in the missile-making business. Western companies that build missiles, including offensive rockets and defensive interceptors, say they are fielding a surge of new orders. Heavy demand for Patriot anti-missile arrays, THAAD interceptors, and Sidewinder missiles is keeping defense contractors from Lockheed Martin to RTX busy, while some other business lines stumble. Lockheed Martin on Tuesday reported an 11% increase in second quarter sales within its missiles and firing control division, which makes Patriot air defense missiles and high-end THAAD interceptors. Revenue rose 8% at RTX Raytheon unit, powered by higher sales of its Patriot equipment and of NASAMS, another surface-to-air missile system. The U.S. Army asked Lockheed to quadruple production of its PAC-3 missiles for Patriot batteries. The company said it expects backlogged orders for its weaponry to hit a record later this year. The backlog of Raytheon swelled to $63.5 billion at the end of June, nudged higher by Navy contracts for new ship-fired SM-3 projectiles and AIM-9X Sidewinder missiles. The demand is very durable, said RTX finance chief Neil Mitchell, citing continuing talks with European customers. That's why we're investing. These are very complicated products and may require a long lead time. The U.S. has been hoarding missiles for several years to strengthen its position in the Pacific region against China. But protracted fighting in Ukraine and the Middle East have drawn down Western missile supplies, according to Wes Runbaugh, a fellow at the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. A lot of the spike in the demand recently that has stressed the U.S. industrial base is the pop-up of conflicts that they weren't expecting, he said. They're sending a very strong short-term signal. The long-term question is whether or not these investments will translate into sustainable funding. the missile boom offers a contrast with other areas of the U.S. defense industrial complex that are struggling to get off the ground. Lockheed surprised investors Tuesday by booking $1.8 billion in write-downs from big-budget jet fighter and helicopter programs. The biggest loss came from a contract in the company's secretive Skunk Works unit, which designs advanced aircraft and other weaponry. The same program booked a $555 million loss last year. Aircraft makers are wrestling with changing orders and costly research and development overruns. Shipbuilders are finding it hard to keep construction costs in check. Drone warfare is changing the way countries around the world equip their armies. Still, the stepped-up demand for missiles is giving a jolt to the entire supply chain. Defense contractor Northrop Grumman said Tuesday it expected to pump out 25,000 solid rocket motors a year by 2029, up from 13,000 units today. Europe's largest missile maker, MBDA, has proven lucrative for its three listed owners, BAE Systems, Airbus, and Leonardo. MBDA now represents 13% of BAE's $44.5 billion order book, up from 6.5% in 2021, just before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. In the first quarter of this year, growth for Norwegian technology company Kongsberg was mainly driven by the increased delivery volumes for missiles and defenses against them. Kongsberg's order backlog for missiles and air defense systems now totals more than $8.4 billion, with sales of a naval strike missile to the U.S. being particularly lucrative. Missile makers could reap another windfall from the Trump administration's Golden Dome for America anti-missile shield project. The president called for an extensive buildup of air and space defenses to protect the U.S. against ballistic missiles and newer threats such as hypersonic weapons. The Defense Department hasn't detailed the high-level design of the anti-missile shield, but Trump's call for an operations system by the end of his term could end up boosting companies such as Lockheed, RTX, and others ready to field more missile interceptors on short notice. Write to Drew Fitzgerald at andrew.fitzgerald@wsj.com. Tesla profit falls, hurt by plunging EV sales. Electric vehicle makers' net income dropped 16% in second quarter. Musk says robotaxis will greatly expand by year's end. By Becky Peterson. Speaking with Wall Street on Wednesday, Tesla chief executive Elon Musk highlighted plans to release a lower-priced Model Y electric vehicle, spoke about his hopes for a new pay package from the company's board in fall, and talked up plans to greatly expand Tesla's robotaxi service to half the country by the end of the year. We're in this weird transition period where we'll lose a lot of incentives in the U.S., he said, alluding to an expiring tax credit designed to boost EV sales, but we're still at the relatively early stages of autonomy. We probably could have a few rough quarters. I'm not saying we will, but we could, Musk added, but said he still expects autonomous vehicles to improve Tesla's finances by the end of next year. The electric vehicle maker's second quarter revenue declined after a big drop in automotive deliveries, which were down 13.5% from a year earlier. Tesla reported a $1.17 billion in net income, down from $1.4 billion the year prior. The company also reported a $22.5 billion in revenue for the quarter, down 12%. Revenue from its automotive businesses fell 16%. The energy business fell 7%. Tesla said its declines in revenue and profitability were due to the drop in sales and a reduction in regulatory credits. Tesla reported $439 million in revenue from other automakers that pay Tesla for carbon credits to offset their sale of conventional vehicles, less than half what it reported a year earlier. Many of those credits will go away this fall after recent changes to federal tax law eliminated many subsidies for EVs and environmental remedies. Tesla's finances have been in free fall since last year, after Musk's entrance into partisan politics brought protests and worsened the company's reputation in once popular regions like California and Europe. Musk's departure from the Trump administration in May and subsequent public disputes with the president have further complicated his relationship with car buyers, who have more options than ever when shopping for an EV in the U.S. and China. Tesla has turned to updates and financing incentives to capture the attention of shoppers. Since March, the company has refreshed its popular Model Y crossover SUV, made updates to its luxury Model S and Model X vehicles, and released its pared-down, lower-cost version of its Cybertruck. Despite the updates, the company sold just 384,122 vehicles in the second quarter, down from 443,956 the year before. Musk has encouraged investors to focus their attention on future revenue streams stemming from its investments in autonomous vehicles and robotics. In June, Tesla launched a small fleet of robotaxis near its headquarters in Austin, Texas. The rideshare app is currently restricted to the downtown and South Congress neighborhoods. Access is by invitation only and priced at $6.90 a ride, up from $4.20 a few weeks ago. Musk said the company expects to expand its service area in Austin in the coming weeks. The company is also seeking to expand to the Bay Area, Nevada, and Florida. If the company can get approvals, the autonomous ride-hailing vehicles could be available to half the country's population, Musk said on a call with investors and analysts Wednesday. Autonomy is the story, Musk said. The company faces more headwinds going into the third quarter as the federal government rewrites policies around EV incentives, eliminating the $7,500 consumer tax credit, as well as many of the vehicle available carbon credits paid by other car manufacturers to Tesla to offset the sale of gasoline-powered vehicles. Write to Becky Peterson at becky.peterson@wsj.com. Biden sells memoir for roughly $10 million, less than Obama and Clinton. Hatchett bought the worldwide rights to the former president's book by Jeffrey A. Tackenberg. Former President Joe Biden has sold his presidential memoir to the Hatchett Book Group for an advance in the range of $10 million, according to people familiar with the matter. The memoir's publisher, Hatchett's Little Brown & Company, hasn't yet set a publication date. Biden, who is 82, said in an event earlier this month that he was working my tail off to write a memoir and indicated that he would focus on the 4 years he served as president. Presidents and their spouses routinely shop memoirs after their time in the White House. Such books can provide a major source of income and help the public figures frame their legacies. Biden was represented by a creative artists agency, which sold Hatchett worldwide rights for the book. CAA also represented Biden for his 2017 memoir, Promise Me, Dad, A Year of Hope, Hardship, and Purpose. The number one bestseller told the story of Biden's relationship with his oldest son, Beau, who died from brain cancer in 2015. Spokeswoman for Hatchett and CAA declined to comment. A representative for Biden declined to comment. Biden's representative said in May that the former president had been diagnosed with prostate cancer. The illness was described in a statement from his personnel office as a more aggressive form of the disease, but one that appears to be hormone-sensitive, which allows for effective management. Biden's health will likely determine the timeline for completing a manuscript and any book publicity plans. Biden's lengthy political career includes an 8-year term as vice president during the Obama administration and 4 years as president between January 21 and January 2025. Biden dropped out of the presidential race in late July 2024 in the face of concerns about his age and mental acuity. Some critics have said that timing contributed to Donald Trump's presidential victory over Vice President Kamala Harris, whom Biden endorsed. Penguin Random House acquired the rights to books by former U.S. President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama in 2017 for a price that was widely reported at the time as being in the range of $60 million. President Trump didn't publish a memoir after his first term in office, Alfred A. Knopf, which, like Penguin Random House, is owned by Bertelsmann, paid $15 million for President Bill Clinton's 2004 memoir, My Life. Write to Jeffrey A. Trachtenberg at jeffrey.trachtenberg, T-R-A-C-H-T-E-N-B-E-R-G, at wsj.com. T-Mobile adds more subscribers than rivals. As the carrier's results beat Wall Street expectations, it raised its full-year forecast by Patience Hagen. T-Mobile U.S. gained wireless and internet subscribers in the second quarter, beating Wall Street's expectations and outpacing rivals. The company also raised its guidance for the full year. T-Mobile added 830,000 net postpaid wireless phone connections in the second quarter, up nearly 7% year over year. It beat expectations of analysts polled by FactSet, who expected 704,500 net additions. The company gained 454,000 net broadband connections in the quarter, up 12% year over year. Analysts polled by FactSet expected 398,800 net additions. Revenue rose nearly 7% year over year to $21.1 billion. Net income rose 10% year over year to $3.2 billion. Earnings per share rose 14% to $2.84. All three figures beat analyst expectations. Shares increased nearly 5% in after-hours trading. The Bellevue, Washington company outperformed competitors Verizon and AT&T during the quarter. Verizon lost 9,000 net postpaid phone connections and added 293,000 net broadband connections. AT&T added 401,000 net postpaid phone connections and 150,000 net broadband connections. T-Mobile's performances suggest its aggressive promotions during the quarter paid off. Among the company's offers was a price lock guarantee that promised new customers a steady rate in its fiber home internet for 5 years. The company is poised to make gains in the business phone service market. On Tuesday, the nation's two largest cable companies, Comcast and Charter, announced an exclusive agreement that allows them to lease access to T-Mobile's network and resell it to business customers across the U.S. beginning next year. T-Mobile raised its guidance for net postpaid customers additions to 6.1 million to 6.4 million for the year, up from 5.5 million to 6.0 million. The company also raised the lower end of its free cash flow guidance and now expects free cash flow between $17.6 billion and $18 billion for 2025. The Federal Communications Commission approved T-Mobile's acquisitions of U.S. Cellular, a carrier covering the Midwestern states. John Fryer, president of T-Mobile's Consumer Group, said the acquisition would give the company an opportunity to grow its customer base in rural areas of the country. Write to Patience Higgin at patience.higgin, H-A-G-G-I-N, at wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. Get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sunshine Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Health Aid Kombucha sells for $500 million. The brand, founded in 2012, is distributed in thousands of locations in the U.S. by Ben Glickman and Laura Cooper. Backers of kombucha brand Health Aid have agreed to sell the company for $500 million, the latest in a series of deals for health-conscious food and beverage brands this year. Generous Brands, a company owned by Butterfly Equity, announced Tuesday that it would acquire Health Aid from fellow private equity investors First Bev and Mana Tree Partners, confirming the Wall Street Journal's prior report. First Bev and Mana Tree will maintain minority stakes in Generous Brands. Health Aid was founded in 2012 and sells various flavors of kombucha, the fermented fizzy tea that is said to benefit gut health. Its products are now distributed in thousands of stores in the U.S. and online. First Bev and Mana Tree initially invested the company in 2021. Generous Brands portfolio includes Sambazon, Akai Juices and Smoothies, Evolution Fresh, a juice brand, and Bolthouse Farms, which sells smoothies and other health-conscious beverages. We feel like we're still at the beginning of this consumer revolution of choosing healthier, tastier products out there, said Generous Brands Chief Executive Steve Cornell in an interview. Big food and drink companies have been looking to expand their offerings that appeal to health-conscious consumers. In March, for instance, PepsiCo agreed to acquire prebiotic soda brand Poppi for nearly $2 billion. Prebiotic drinks claim to support digestive health with dietary fibers that feed the bacteria already living in our systems. Probiotic drinks such as kombucha and kefir introduce new microbes into the gut. More processed foods and drinks, meanwhile, have come under growing criticism from the so-called Make America Healthy Again movement, championed by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. Health Aid's sale would mark the third exit from Mana Tree, which was co-founded by Illy Rubinstein, daughter of Carlyle Group co-founder David Rubinstein, and focuses on healthy living products. First Bev was invested in Essentials Water, which sold to Nestle in 2021, and alcohol delivery app Drizzly, which was acquired by Uber Technologies for $1.1 billion the same year. Write to Ben Glickman at ben.glickman at wsj.com and Laura Cooper at laura.cooper at wsj.com. Reckitt to sell home care unit majority stake to Advent at up to $4.8 billion valuation. The consumer group has been pursuing a major revamp of its portfolio. By Elena Varden, Reckitt Benckiser is selling a majority stake in its home care business, home to Airwick fresheners and Clickit Bang cleaning products, to Advent International in a deal that values the whole unit at up to $4.8 billion, including debt. The UK Consumer Goods Group has been pursuing a major revamp of its portfolio to sharpen its focus on core brands like Lysol, Dettol, and Strepsils, which drive the bulk of its sales. The plan involves exiting its home care business called Essential Home and looking at options for its baby formula maker, Mead Johnson Nutrition, which is facing legal issues in the U.S. that have weighed on the group's stock price. Several of the world's biggest consumer goods companies are seeking to resize their product portfolios after a pullback in consumer spending put the sector under pressure. Consumer health company Kenvue last week said it would launch a strategic review and consider steps to simplify its portfolio. And Tide detergent maker Procter & Gamble in June said it would trim its brand lineup. Reckitt's UK peer Unilever plans to complete a spin-off of its ice cream business, set to be called Magnum Ice Cream, by the end of the year, while Nescafe owner Nestle is exploring options for its water business. Reckitt, which makes products ranging from cold medication Mucinex to Durex condoms, said Friday that it would keep a 30% stake in the business as part of the deal with private equity group Advent. It expects to hand about $2.2 billion to shareholders through a special dividend after the sale's closing, while continuing to carry out an existing buyback program. Shares on Reckitt traded around 2% higher in European morning trade. "We are executing our strategic plan at pace," Reckitt chief executive Chris Licht said. News of the deal came after Reckitt continued in April. The timeline for its essential home exit might slip amid market volatility caused by President Trump's tariff plans, but that it still aimed to unload the business by year end. Essential Home operates across the air care, surface pest, and laundry segments, and includes brands such as Mortine, Calgon, Woolite, Resolve, Soul, and EasyOff, along with 75 others in more than 70 markets. The division brought in £2.0 billion, that's $2.68 billion, of net revenue last year, or around 14% of Reckitt's total. Final proceeds from the sale of Reckitt will be subject to balance sheet adjustments and the value of its stake in the business. The company said Reckitt's immediate cash proceeds will likely be around $1.3 billion, analysts at RBC Capital Markets wrote in a note to clients. Reckitt expects to mitigate the costs relating to the separation of the unit, which it estimates at around $800 million, mostly in 2026, and stuck with its previous cost guidance. As majority owner, Advent plans to accelerate investment in Essential Homes brands to drive growth, it said. Advent and Reckitt are aligned in their strategic vision for the business, it added. The deal is expected to close by the end of the year. Write to Lena Varden at elena.varden@wsj.com. UnitedHealth contacts Justice Department following reports of Medicare billing probe. The company says it has begun complying with formal criminal and civil requests from the agency. By Denny Jacob, UnitedHealth Group said it has proactively reached out to the Justice Department after reviewing reports about investigations into certain aspects of its participation in the Medicare program. The Wall Street Journal earlier this month reported that the Justice Department's Criminal Healthcare Fraud Unit is investigating the healthcare conglomerate's Medicare billing practices, including how the company deployed doctors and nurses to gather diagnoses that bolstered its payments. UnitedHealth, in the securities filing Thursday, said it has now begun complying with formal criminal and civil requests from the Justice Department. It added that it has full confidence in its practices and is committed to working cooperatively through the process. The journal has first reported in May that the healthcare fraud unit was overseeing a probe of the company's Medicare business, noting that the investigation dated back to at least last summer. Then in July, the journal reported that former UnitedHealth employees said they had been questioned by prosecutors working for the healthcare fraud unit. the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General also participated in some of the interviews, according to the report. A UnitedHealth spokesman earlier this month said that the company welcomes regular reviews of our policies and practices and that it engages with government agencies directly and not through the press. Following the journal's reporting, UnitedHealth released a statement saying it would deploy a regular, independent third-party oversight and audit process for its diagnosis recording practices. Write to Denny Jacob at denny.jacob@wsj.com. Manhattan Project waste linked to higher risk of cancer. New study is among first to examine cancer risk among people exposed to lower levels of environmental radiation by Brianna Abbott. People who spent their childhood in the 1940s, 50s, or 60s living near Coldwater Creek, a tributary of the Missouri River in St. Louis County, grew up in the shadow of the atomic bomb. Now, new research suggests they faced a heightened risk of cancer, likely because of radiation exposure from the polluted creek. As part of the Manhattan Project, uranium was processed in downtown St. Louis during the World War II. The nuclear waste was then moved around 15 miles north for storage at sites near the St. Louis Airport, where it leached into Coldwater Creek. The area is part of the formerly utilized Sites Remedial Action Program for places contaminated with radioactive materials from the nation's early atomic energy and weapons program. In the years after World War II, the closer children lived to Coldwater Creek, the higher their risk for various cancers compared with those who lived further away, according to a paper published in JAMA Network Open on Wednesday. The results, I think, were really persuasive, said Dr. Rebecca Smith-Bindman, professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco, who studies radiation risk from medical imaging and wasn't involved in the paper. It emphasizes the importance of appreciating that radioactive waste is carcinogenic, particularly to children, and that we have to ensure that we have to clean up any remaining waste that's out there, she said. In late 2024, more than 25 years after cleanup of the area started, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said it started installing warning signs along the creek on properties that still needed to be cleared of contamination. The study is among the first to look at cancer risk among people who are exposed to lower levels of environmental radiation, as opposed to high levels such as those experienced by Japanese atomic bomb survivors, the researchers said. Exposure to high doses of radiation is linked to a greater risk of leukemia, breast, bladder, and other cancers, according to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. All people are exposed to daily background radiation from sources including minerals, cosmic rays, and medical X-rays, said Dr. Howard Sandler, chair of radiation oncology at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. But the dose and the reason for exposure matters. When I use radiation, it can be used to cure cancer, Sandler said. But radiation, when it's given unnecessarily, only causes risk. Nearby residents of Coldwater Creek have long expressed concern about the potential health risks. The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, which exists within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, released a report on the exposure in 2019, saying that the contamination before cleanup activities could have increased the risk of leukemia and bone and lung cancer. More recent exposures, starting in the 2000s, slightly increased risk of lung cancer for those who live nearby. But the predicted increase in the number of cancers was small, the agency said, and there was no foolproof way to link any person's particular cancer with the exposure, a common problem for health officials and patients when investigating potential environmental cancer risks. There usually isn't a single cause for why a person develops cancer, and the genetic, behavioral, and environmental factors are difficult to tease apart. In the new study, researchers tapped into an old database of people who lived in the greater St. Louis area as children between 1958 and 1972 and donated their baby teeth to help measure radiation exposure. The researchers tracked down and surveyed some 4,200 participants, now in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, who self-reported their cancer incidents. Mark Weisskopf, senior author of the study and a professor of epidemiology and physiology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, had originally set out to test the impact of early life metal exposure using the teeth, but cancer had been the community's chief concern, prompting the team to look into it, he said. We wound up being quite surprised at what we saw, he said. The closer the childhood residents got to Coldwater Creek, the risk of cancer went up, and pretty dramatically. About a quarter of the participants reported having cancer at some point. Those who lived less than 1 kilometer away from the creek, a kilometer is 0.62 miles, and 85% greater risk of cancers known to be linked to radiation, including breast and thyroid cancers and leukemia, compared with the people who lived 20 kilometers away. The risk went down for those who lived 1 to 5 kilometers away, compared to the closest group, and then down slightly more for those who lived between 5 and 20 kilometers away. Those who lived at least 20 kilometers away had the lowest risk. The link was also stronger for men compared with women, potentially because young boys might have been more likely to play in the creek than girls in that area, increasing their exposure. The researchers didn't measure radiation directly in the study, so the work doesn't prove that the waste is to blame, Weisskopf said, and the team didn't get access to the participants' medical records to confirm the self-reported cancers. Weisskopf wants to examine the radiation exposure using the baby teeth, but future funding isn't secure, he said. Earlier this month, Congress brought back and expanded the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act as part of President Trump's new tax law. The program provides a cash benefit for people who might have developed cancer or other specific diseases after radiation exposure from atomic weapons, testing, or uranium mining or transport. It now includes zip codes near Coldwater Creek. Write to Brianna Abbott at brianna.abbott@wsj.com. And here's an opinion article by the editorial board. The price of winning the trade war. The Japan deal is a relief, but only because the alternative was worse. The trade deal President Trump announced with Japan Tuesday evening is good news in the narrow sense that it diffuses what could have been an extended tariff war with America's most important ally in Asia. But if this is winning the trade war, we'd hate to see what losing looks like. Mr. Trump hailed the pact with characteristic modesty as perhaps the biggest deal ever made. Details remain sparse, but the core appears to be a Japanese commitment to invest $550 billion in the U.S. while reducing barriers to imports of American agriculture products, such as rice. In exchange, Mr. Trump will reduce his reciprocal tariffs on Japan to 15% from 25%, including apparently on autos. The new tariff rate is good news only as relief from 25%. This is still a 15% tax increase on imports from Japan. And don't believe the White House spin that Japanese exporters will pay this tax. They might absorb some of it, depending on the product and the competition. But American businesses and consumers will pay more too, and thus be either less competitive or have a lower standard of living. That $550 billion in new Japanese investment also sounds better than it may be once we know the details. Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba suggested Tokyo will offer government loans and guarantees to support these investments, with the aim to build resilient supply chains in key sectors. This raises the prospect that this money, if it arrives, will be tied up in Japanese industrial policy, an American industrial policy, since Mr. Trump said Japan will make these investments at my direction, and the U.S. will receive 90% of the profits. Yikes. By the way, more investment inflows by deflation mean a larger trade deficit in the U.S. balance of payments. Has someone told the president about this? The U.S. could have had more Japanese investment all along, except Mr. Trump helped chase it away. The current president and President Biden did their best to thwart a $14.9 billion acquisition of U.S. steel by Nippon Steel ahead of last year's election, before Mr. Trump acquiesced in June. Perhaps if Japanese companies were more confident that they'd get a fair shake in the U.S., we wouldn't need all these loan guarantees and trade deals to unlock capital commitments for American jobs. One positive development is the apparent reduction in U.S. auto tariffs from 25%. Perhaps the administration is noticing that forcing Americans to pay higher prices for the cars they want to buy isn't a political winner. Yet, the 15% rate still marks a substantial increase over the 2.5% tariff that applied to passenger cars before Mr. Trump took office. The U.S. already applies a 25% tariff on imported trucks. This highlights the economic bramble into which Mr. Trump has stumbled with his tariffs first, negotiate later approach to trade. U.S. automakers are worried that Japanese companies will enjoy preferential tariff rates, while Detroit could be stuck paying 25% on imports of cars and parts that U.S. companies ship from Mexico and Canada. As for the claim that Mr. Trump is winning this trade war, that depends on how you define victory. It's true Mr. Trump is showing he can bully much of the world into accepting higher tariffs. The size of the U.S. market is powerful negotiating leverage. The pleasant surprise so far is that most countries haven't retaliated, which has spared the world from a 1930s-style downward trade spiral. But Mr. Trump is showing the world that the U.S. can change access to its market on presidential whim. Countries will diversify their trading relationships accordingly, as they already are in new bilateral and multilateral deals that exclude the U.S. China will expand its commercial influence at the expense of the U.S. Beijing has also shown that two can play trade bully ball. It retaliated against Mr. Trump's 145% tax tariffs with export restraints on vital minerals, and Mr. Trump agreed to a truce. By the time this trade war ends, if it ever does, the average U.S. tariff rate may settle close to 15% from 2.4% in January. That's an anti-growth tax increase. The question for Trumponomics now in the first term is whether the pro-growth elements of his tax and deregulatory agenda overwhelm the tariff damage. The Japan deal is at least one step towards removing harmful trade uncertainty. As important question is what this augurs for talks with other trading partners, and especially the European Union. The Japan deal is in some ways been easier, especially since a big sticking point was agricultural protectionism. Tokyo can reduce if pushed. Talks with Brussels encompass thornier problems, such as Europe's tech and pharma excess profits taxes and Europe's chronic complaints about U.S. financial regulations. Trump, Coke, and the sugar cartel. The president says things go better with cane sugar, so stop eating corn syrup, by the editorial board. President Trump is pressing Coca-Cola to make its U.S. soft drinks with cane sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup. And on Tuesday, the company said it will launch Mr. Trump's preferred version as a new product this fall. Consumers will decide if it succeeds, but if Mr. Trump wants to help, he could dismantle U.S. sugar protectionism that gives corn syrup a cost advantage. This episode is a collusion between MAGA-style economics and populist nutrition. Scientific authorities generally say there isn't a big difference between, healthy-wise, between corn syrup and sugar, and the important thing is not to chug too much of either. A soda isn't carrot juice, no matter the sweetener. Yet Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has called corn syrup a formula for making you obese and diabetic. He's a man of the left who blames America's health problems on big corporations. Soda aficionados also said that they can taste the difference, which is what Mr. Trump seemed to cite. I have been speaking to Coca-Cola about using real cane sugar in the Coke in the United States, and they've agreed to do so, he wrote on Truth Social. This will be a very good move by them. You'll see. It's just better. Having ended the Ukraine and Gaza wars, Mr. Trump apparently has a time to tell soda makers what to put in their bottles. Coca-Cola's statement was that it plans to sell an offering made with U.S. cane sugar, but is as a complement to its existing U.S. lineup. In other words, corn syrup isn't being phased out. Since it's cheaper, that's no surprise. The federal government props up sugar prices to the benefit of U.S. producers, particularly, but not exclusively, in Florida, by meddling in markets with a complicated tariff quota system. In 2022, U.S. wholesale refined sugar prices were more than double the world price, the Government Accountability Office said in 2023. Its report cited estimates that U.S. sugar producers get a productionist windfall of $1.4 billion to $2.7 billion a year, but sugar users lose an estimated $2.5 billion to $3.5 billion of consumer benefit, making it a net loss. Also, high U.S. sugar prices are another incentive for confectioners and food manufacturers to set up shop elsewhere. It's classic protectionism. The government gives concentrated benefits to sugar producers. The costs are borne by everybody, but they are diffuse. The program is a net loss for the country, but the subsidized industry becomes influential and will spend money in politics to preserve its take. The downstream jobs that never get created because of the protectionist policies don't have anyone to stand up for them because they don't exist. By the way, Mr. Trump is threatening to levy a new 50% tariff on imports from Brazil. What does the U.S. buy from there? Cane sugar. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.